From the National Humanities Center at Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings, conversations featuring scholars and visitors at the National Humanities Center. For American audiences, the movies date from 1896. By 1947, weekly moviegoers in the United States outnumbered the entire American population several times over. And almost from their beginnings, it's been clear that the movies constitute important commercial and aesthetic forces in American society. But what about the future of the movies and of cinema studies? That was the primary question on the agenda of a recent symposium convened at the National Humanities Center under the direction of the Society for Cinema Studies. Among the conferees were three film historians and educators, Robert Allen, John Kuiper, and Russell Merritt. Robert Allen is a professor at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill and an officer in the Society for Cinema Studies. John Kuiper is the director of the Department of Film in the International Museum of Photography at the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York. Russell Merritt is a professor of communication arts at the University of Wisconsin. The following Soundings discussion is the conclusion of a two-part conversation about media and society. John, let me begin with you. Are we going to go to the movies in 20 years? What's it going to look like?
Oh, I think, Wayne, in some way or another, we will be. It's film, if we mean by movies, film. I think we have to be precise here. If you mean by film, silver image film in color, I think in 20 years, we'll be going to the movies as a mass audience. They're liable to be on very much bigger screens. And they're liable to be specialized. They're already there, I think, 13 theaters in the country that have screen the size of a building. They're liable to be, and so they'll be spectacular. The spectacular elements that have always been in cinema, I think, will stay with us. It's going to be one of the few ways to do it. Eventually, maybe even that will be converted into an electronic image. But my friends who are even deeper into technology say that it's quite a long ways away. 86% of film cinema now, images are originated on film. So there'll be something.
John Kuiper's comments suggest a couple of possibilities. Russ Merritt, let me ask you, in terms of technological elements and in terms of content, how do you think the movies are going to change?
In terms of content, I can be a little bit more precise than I can with technology, about which I have no real expertise. But I would say that with, in terms of content, we are probably going to see a continuation of this marriage between film and television. That one of the most striking shifts in content from the 1960s and 70s to the 1980s is that in the early 70s, we had such a close interconnection between the cinema of the United States and the cinema of Europe, that the real accent was on studying French, Italian, Japanese films, and as they connect with American films. Now, those connections have been severed almost entirely in favor of connections between the motion picture industry and the television industry. Whereas once upon a time, you went to the movies to see what you couldn't see on television, now you go to the movies to see what you're going to see on television 6 months from now. And the other kind of synergistic effect that exists between the two is much more surprising, which is that you would imagine, I think, that the influx of VCRs, of cable networks, would have a absolutely devastating effect on movie attendance in theaters. It has had just the opposite effect, that the theater industry has been in something of a recovery period, and that if John Kuiper is right, and we see this increasing magnitude and increase in the size of the movie screen, we're going to see either more expensive spectacles, and we're going to watch these movies that are designed specifically for those summer audiences and for the teenage audiences. Increasingly, the kind of, quote, adult fare is restricted to those sorts of liberal family kind of pictures that squeeze out so many themes. When's the last time you've seen a historical film, for instance, or a film that is concerned with unorthodox issues? There's a wide range of movie topics that seems to be squeezed out with this marriage.
Bobby, let me ask you to comment on that.
I think, getting back to the question that Wayne asked to begin with, if we're going to be going to the movies in 20 years, I think John's answer that yes, we will be going to the movies in 20 years needs to be qualified to some degree, because we might not be we. We might be only people between the ages of 16 and 22 mm-hmm. In 20 years. In other words, the thing that saved this whole discussion of are the movies dead is nothing that is a phenomenon of the 1980s. It is, in fact, a replay of a controversy or a discussion that occurred in the 1940s and 50s.
Well, just parenthetically, Russ Merritt used the term the marriage of film and television, and it certainly didn't start as a marriage.
Oh, no. It was two industries who were really very much at odds with each mm-hmm. other in the late 40s and early 1950s. But the argument between 1952 and 1958, let's say, mm-hmm. was that films were dead because why would someone go outside their house and pay at that time, what, $1.75?
An outrageous amount.
An outrageous amount of money to see something that they could see in their own homes. Mm-hmm. And it seemed, economically speaking, a prima facie case for the demise of film. Well, films, of course, did not die in the early 1950s. They survived, underwent some changes, of course, but survived to flourish today. Mm-hmm. The point is that what saved the movies in the 1950s was that they served a function for the moviegoer that watching television in your home does not serve.
Okay.
A social function.
Uh-huh.
There's a difference between calling up someone saying, hi, would you like to go out to the movies, and saying, hi, would you like to come over and watch Bonanza on television? And as long as the movies continue to serve a social function, which they have, not only in the 1950s, but going all the way back to the initial commercial exploitation of the motion picture technology in the 1890s, so long as they serve a social function, so that going to the movies has other meanings attached to it in addition to simply watching images unroll before you on a screen, which you certainly can do at home, and with the advent of video cassettes and direct satellite broadcasting and whatnot, will probably become more economically feasible to stay at home and do that. But there's a difference between doing that in your living room and making an event of going out to a public place, a movie theater, buying your popcorn, sitting in a seat. And if that can be social function can be combined by giving the audience certain forms of entertainment that they cannot get on television, or that television does not provide as well, technological spectacle, disreputable forms that as yet have not made it into commercial television mm-hmm. venues, those kinds of things, then the movies will continue to exist, but perhaps primarily as a form of entertainment for a much narrower segment of the audience mm-hmm. than is true today, or certainly was true in the 1950s.
Let me, correct me if I'm wrong, Russ Merritt, Bobby Allen, and John Kuiper, are you all talking about marketing? Are you talking about the business deal behind, you know, and the term for all of this is the industry. Are you talking about who makes the deal aimed at which particular part of a demographic target? I remember hearing a story on the radio recently that movies aren't movies. They're just dark, large rooms attached to popcorn machines and soda fountains and candy sales. Is that too cynical to view it that way when you talk about the future of the movies and the art of cinema? John Kuiper?
Well, it's too simple. There's an element of truth in it. But as far as I know, there's still a great element of risk mm-hmm. With any film that's released as to exactly how it's going to be received commercially.
But don't the deal makers really try to minimize that? They try to figure out who the audience is and how we're going to please them. And we do a lot of surveys and we, isn't this what the script writers and the directors complain about, that they are sacrificing their artistic ideals and compromising their aims? Russ Merritt?
Yeah, that's exactly, of course, how Hollywood wants to operate. Mm-hmm. It wants to rationalize the industry. And in many ways, we play into that because it is a fascinating aspect.
We the public?
We the educators.
Uh-huh.
Because it is such a fascinating tactic or a fascinating aspect of film, the industrial decisions and the practical aspects of decision making that have to be considered when you're investing such huge sums of money.
Mm-hmm.
But the track record of these experts is lousy, and thank God that it is so terrible.
Yeah.
I recently went through a list of the most expensive films ever made, and I suspect that it wouldn't be very easy to list off the top of your head what the most expensive movies ever made were. They would include Superman 1, which is the single most expensive movie ever made.
Just parenthetically, tell us how much it cost.
Oh, I wish you wouldn't ask me that because I'm
but
so
in the
bad
millions
on figures.
And millions, huh?
It'd probably be, as I recall, it was something like $70 million. And that was followed by Annie. And there were other ones way up there, Inchon and other titles of that caliber. The interesting thing is that among the 10 most expensive movies ever made, three made money. And in fact, we always like to think of Heaven's Gate as the archetypal box office bonanza or box office disaster that was budgeted with great amounts of money. But in fact, it's a piker compared to some of these other projects. The point is that what is essentially so exciting about the motion picture industry is that it is unpredictable, that what you can count on is being surprised. And the risk makers are, and risk takers, are not necessarily those who are risking the millions of dollars. They're risking unorthodox themes. They're risking new kinds of, or revivals of genres that were once thought of as being discredited. And that's always been the hope of the American industry. And of course, the other hope is that there are alternatives to, depending upon the box office, for the creation of movies. And we are still trying to find our way out through other ways of making film projects available, making them available to the screen.
Bobby Allen?
Let me offer for your response the argument that if we place our faith in the art house movement as being the source of alternative viewing pleasure in the United States, that it is in fact a misplaced faith. The economics of film production, distribution, and exhibition still obtain. There will probably always be those kinds of films that come along, one or two a year, that keep the art houses open, that are successful enough to actually make some money, or they're produced in foreign countries with tax write-offs or loan guarantees or whatnot, where the investors can recover their costs through some kind of government intervention. But that, in fact, if we want to look to the area of popular entertainment where alternative programming is most likely to flourish, that it is not on the big screen, but that it is on the little screen. Because the economics of video cassette production, of cable television, of direct satellite broadcasting are such that, and also the competition for smaller segments of the viewing audience mean that the door is much more open in those sorts of electronic venues than are likely to be open in terms of commercial film exhibition. Real estate prices are not likely to drop. Labor costs are not likely to go down. The cost of keeping a building open so that people can go into it at two-hour intervals is not likely to go down. The cost of getting to those theaters is not likely to go down. The cost of hiring a babysitter in order to be able to do that is not likely to go down. Those fixed costs will militate against any kind of flourishing of alternative cinema in the United States, I think, except cinema which we see on little boxes or that we go down to the neighborhood video store and rent or buy. Mm-hmm. One final thing, I think one of the things that has long prevented certain alternative forms of movies from flourishing has been the odious comparison between the production values of alternative narrative films in particular and the production values that Hollywood has always been so famous for. Glaring money shows up on the screen, or it can show up on the screen. And I'm speaking now of films that are palatable not just to we PhDs who live in communities where there are enough PhDs to support art houses, but of broadening the appeal and the audience for alternative films. And I think those odious production value comparisons have helped to keep people away from alternative films and might not keep them away from alternative television, where the production values don't show up and where the comparison mm-hmm. perhaps is not quite so odious. Mm-hmm. Just a hypothesis.
From the National Humanities Center, this is Wayne Pond with Soundings. You're listening to the second of two discussions about media and society. The topic at hand is the future of cinema and cinema studies, the subject of a recent symposium convened at the National Humanities Center under the auspices of the Society for Cinema Studies. The Soundings panelists are three film historians and educators, Robert Allen, John Kuiper, and Russell Merritt. Robert Allen directs the graduate program in the Department of Radio, Television, and Motion Pictures at the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill. John Kuiper is director of the Department of Film in the International Museum of Photography at the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York. Russell Merritt is a professor of communication arts at the University of Wisconsin.
Russ Merritt, Bobby Allen, John Kuiper, our topic is the future of cinema and cinema studies. You are, as Russ has pointed out, film educators. You deal with young and tender minds. How do you tell the parent of a student, how do you say, well, what I'm doing is worthwhile, it's... they're all pointing to Bobby Allen.
And I'm pointing away just to...
how do you, I guess a harsh word would be justify film studies. How do you put it into the university? Does it have a future in that sense? And what is it?
Well, it seems to me that if you spend a fair portion of your life engaged in experiences with images that bounce off walls or come out of television sets, that even if one does not intend to go into the production of those products, films or television programs, that one will continue to be a consumer of those products for the rest of one's life, unless you plan to be a hermit or mm-hmm. a monk.
And therefore affected by them.
And therefore in a position perhaps to affect mm-hmm. Certainly the way in which you interact with them, and possibly to affect the kinds of programming that you interact with. I teach media criticism, and my students very often ask me, how is this going to help me get a job? How does it relate to what I'm going to be doing when I get out of here? Do I need to be someone who's going to Hollywood in order to benefit from your course? And my answer is, it seems to me that it is irrelevant whether you're going to be an insurance salesman or a farmer or a film producer. You're still going to be a part of this huge audience for visual media.
And the fact that you can buy a ticket or turn a switch on and off.
Exactly. And let me amplify on that a little bit, and I'll turn it over to Russell. Where that's going to come up in one's life, the need for the knowledge of the way that media are produced and that we interact with them, it's difficult to anticipate when you're facing a 19-year-old person. But I would say that armed with that knowledge, if one is going to be an insurance salesman, that one will be a better person, not necessarily a better mm-hmm. insurance salesman, but a better person for possessing that knowledge.
Russ Merritt?
I'd like to take the counterpoint. I should first mention, is someone who I think is sensitive to the social aspects of the cinema and the importance of educating those to be aware of issues of manipulation and issues that arise from the popularity of genres. And I suppose that the most dramatic instance I had of that was involved in a case that we had up in Wisconsin involving a high school teacher who was fired for teaching The Exorcist, the school board being utterly incensed that someone would be showing this R-rated film to children who had not reached the appropriate age. But I believe that that my principal goal in teaching is not to analyze the social implications of the art insofar as they were just described. It is rather to look and try to analyze what used to be called art. And I am less interested in using criteria of social acceptance as a criteria by which to try and study it, which introduces its own totally legitimate series of questions, as I am in trying to find out how it happened and where it might go. I guess I'm not as much interested as a final rationale in the influence of the artwork over a mass audience as I am over a single member in the audience.
Well, if Russ Merritt is speaking then from the standpoint of a, well, I won't use the word elitist, but if he's talking—
Oh, by all means. I mean, you can use it, elitist.
All right. If he's speaking from the standpoint of an elitist touchstone, and Bobby Allen defends the movies from the standpoint of a pop culture and one who analyzes pop culture. John Kuiper, maybe I'm going to be unfair to you in putting the question to you. Is there a middle ground?
Well,
does there have to be an exclusionary sort of thing?
No, I'd like to speak from, if I could, from the standpoint of the student.
Uh-huh. Yeah, the forgotten ingredient in this conversation.
If you pose the question, a father or a parent calls and say, you know, in a sense, what are you permitting my son to do?
Yeah.
And my response would be, wouldn't you like him or her, or my son or daughter, wouldn't you like him or her to study something that they're really enthusiastic about, that they have an everyday contact with, isn't part of education, part of learning, being excited, being motivated to do it? We know brilliant people who never get what we call an education because they don't give a darn.
Well, what if the parent says it's the kid's interested and enthusiastic, but it's cotton candy?
No, it's not. I say cinema swallows all the arts.
Uh-huh.
Cinema swallows all subject matter. He can study it all by studying cinema.
Hmm.
And that's what we're going to see that he does.
Bobby Allen, Russ Merritt, John Kuiper, our topic is the future of cinema and cinema studies. Let me put a question to you that I hope will tie many of the comments that you've been making together. Why does film deserve a future? How would you characterize, why should it have a history for both popular and academic audiences? Bobby Allen?
Well, let me answer the question by going back to the first part of your query, which is, why is it that cinema deserves to have a future? And I don't know that it does. Uh-huh. I don't know that it will. And I don't know that I will be destroyed, either professionally or emotionally, if I read in the New York Times or on the teletext of my video display screen that, in fact, the last movie has unrolled in the last theater in the United States, and that people are no longer going to be eating popcorn and sitting in the dark anymore and watching images and unroll upon them on the wall in front of their faces. If cinema deserves to exist into the 21st century, it will deserve to do so because people will want it to do so and are willing to pay the price for its being able to do so. The cinema is a 19th century technology. There's no way around it. Whether or not it will be able to find its niche in the 21st century as it's been able to do so in the 20th century is, I think, an open question. But if it does not, the world will not, in fact, come to an end.
Mm-hmm.
And so long as we academic professionals don't wed ourselves to that 19th century technology and the functions that it once served, then I don't think that there's anything to fear about the future.
Russ Merritt?
The motion picture is still a young, vital kind of industry. The remarkable thing is that in a rather short period of time, it is proven not only a remarkably popular art form, no longer, I think, the most popular art form, and nobody, I think, would try to make the argument that it's any longer the most popular art form, but still, its grounding continues to be a popular art form. That, to me, isn't the most remarkable thing. It is both a remarkable art form that has managed, in a rather short period of time, to create remarkable works, and that it's that combination that has married both commerce as well as a standard of quality that is especially intriguing to me. And I think that the fact that we continue to discover, even in rather prosaic films and in routine films, standards of craftsmanship, particularly in films made in this country in the 20s and the 30s and into the 40s, stand as a kind of durable monument to what Americans were able to produce in the times when Hollywood flourished in its golden age, and perhaps a kind of example for the kinds of entertainments that will be made into the 80s, 90s, and the 21st century. Like Bobby, I am less concerned about whether the traditions of film survive on a piece of motion picture film or on some other form of technology than I am that the traditions of the kind of storytelling and craftsmanship standards that have been created can be revived. We're now in a point in which the those standards of craftsmanship have become quite mediocre in many respects, and that in fact we can use the past as in fact a kind of reproach to many aspects of what has happened in the present. In other ways, of course, we have gone far beyond what anybody would have dreamt possible in terms of technology and in terms of experimentation with art technology than we were even able to discover in the 50s or in the 20s, two other periods of remarkable technological ferment.
Bobby, Allen.
I was thinking, as Russell was saying, about film being a young medium. It perhaps is worth pointing out at the end of this conversation that perhaps if film has a future, it lies not in the context in which it arose in Western Europe and in the United States, but in fact in Latin America, in Africa, in the Middle East, in places where the sorts of functions that cinema once served for us may continue to serve for a very long time in the future. And where the penetration of electronic media that we take for granted simply does not exist.
Mm-hmm. Oh, John Kuiper.
I have just come back from Africa talking to filmmakers, and I think one of the things I found out there is that there are things they cannot express in their culture by using Western technology, and I think they will eventually, when their economies are straightened out, will make inventions, technical inventions, that will change, inevitably change the 19th century technology that we're using. But I don't think the need for it. I feel very optimistic that there will be something in image making, electronic, cinema, still, or whatever, that will continue because we need it as human beings.
The program is Soundings. This is Wayne Pond at the National Humanities Center. You've been listening to the concluding segment in a two-part discussion about media and society. The panelists for Soundings were Robert Allen of the University of North Carolina at Chapel Hill, John Kuiper of the International Museum of Photography at the George Eastman House in Rochester, New York, and Russell Merritt of the University of Wisconsin. Next week on Soundings, a conversation about republics, ancient and modern. The Soundings panelists will be Paul Ray of the American Research Institute in Turkey, George Kennedy of the University of North Carolina, and Mark Plattner, formerly a member of the United States delegation to the United Nations. Soundings would like to hear from you. Send your comments to the National Humanities Center, Research Triangle Park, North Carolina, 27709. Soundings is made possible by grants from the National Endowment for the Humanities.